of you young gentlemen tonight.
Really, it's one of my greatest pleasures to speak with intelligent college students. Because the future of the world is in your hands. There's a grave responsibility. The future doctors, the future politicians, the future directors of all welfare institutions, the future judges, the future managers of business, corporation, industry, it's all in the colleges today. And each one of you should really seriously consider the responsibility that is in your hands, especially here at such a distinguished university as IIT, the most prestigious of all colleges, perhaps, in all of the land of India, which is the largest democracy on the face of the earth. Because it's well known that one who honorably graduates from this university, practically the doors are opened to the greatest leadership positions in society. It is explained in Bhagavad Gita, yad yad acharati sreshtas tad tad evetero jana sayat pramanam kurute lokas tad anuvartate. That means what the leaders of society do, the common people will follow in their footsteps. The standards that they set and establish by their example is what the world pursues. So, therefore, it is my very sincere and honest belief that the education that you are now assimilating in your lives is the future of the world. And what this world needs in leaders is not simply good technicians, but people who have a strong moral character, people who understand how to live according to the principle of truth. After all, if you build a house on a weak foundation, it doesn't have much substance. If you base any mathematical equation on an erroneous premise, then anything that follows that must be erroneous. So the first question, the most important question in life, is what is truth? Who am I? What is the real purpose of my existence in this world? And if that part of your education is in order, then anything that you build upon that through all of your studies will be constructive, both to yourselves, to your countrymen, family members, and all the world. Otherwise, we simply become, with our big, big brains, a big, big problem to ourselves and to the world. There are hundreds and millions of examples of people who were given everything as far as wealth, education, prestige, but they were utterly frustrated. Just like very recently, it was in the newspapers, it was about a year ago, the President of the United States, when I was young, was John F. Kennedy. You've heard of him? I think it was seventh grade, and I was sitting in the class, And on the loudspeaker, the principal of the school announced that the President of the United States today has been killed. And everyone in the school was crying because they actually loved him. He's the last president of that country that people liked. The whole nation was weeping. Now, before he died, his family was the most popular family in all of the land. There was everyone in the whole country simply wanted to know what his wife was wearing, what games his children were playing, and his two little children were like the attraction of everybody's attention and what he was doing with them. And everyone was thinking, my God, these children, what a bright future they have. If only my children could have such a bright future, how lucky they are. Admitted to the best universities, so much money, so much popularity. Recently, John Jr. died of an overdose of heroin, I believe. Out of utter frustration. I know he was arrested for possession of heroin, and I have heard that he also overdosed. So what does that mean? Although he had all of these sought-after opulences of the world, he was an empty shell of a man. He was frustrated. He didn't know why he should live. He had no reason. I know in America, and I know in Japan, the highest rates of suicides are in the best colleges of the countries. Do you know that? This is a statistical fact. These are people who have the most brilliant futures in store for them, but they're frustrated. Poor people don't go to psychiatrists and psychologists. It's the rich people. Because they have everything except the meaning. Why am I alive? I have everything, but no peace, no happiness, no fulfillment. Therefore, they have to just tell all their problems to somebody and pay them enormous amounts of money. And they give them some sort of tranquilizers. And there's no solution. We don't want to be just decorating dead corpses. You can decorate a dead corpse very beautifully, but there's nothing in it. Big, big, wonderful education without an inner direction, an inner meaning, an inner fulfillment to life is just decorating a corpse. You become a hollow shell. But that hollow shell is decorated with wonderful degrees, PhDs, MAs, beautiful three-piece suit, lives in a big penthouse, but there's no one home. There's nothing inside. Simply a lonely, frustrated heart. And what can you do for others in that state? You can decorate their dead shells. But the real food that is required in humanity today, our society, is truth. So let us base our education on this premise of truth. And unfortunately, the universities today, for whatever reason, they're not allowed to teach what is truth. In the name of secularism. And we have nothing against that principle, but somehow or other, we should find that educational place where we can harmonize this education with the most essential and important education of who am I? What is the goal of life? If there is a God, something that everybody's been talking about since time immemorial, who is this God and what is my relationship? And with this foundation, then we can build upon it, and we can build wonderful, wonderful structures through everything we do, everything we say, for the enrichment of our own lives and for the upliftment of all humanity. So this basic question of who am I? Very important, because most people, although they learn all about history, geometry, geography, computer technology, biology, physics, chemistry, business management, and they superimpose all of this data upon their brains, most people never really seriously ask, who is it that's learning all this? And of course, if you do ask, most people just speculate in one way or other. They don't consider that there is a science. There is a process of understanding that inner truth, which is our consciousness. We have medical science to take care of the body. We have psychiatric sciences to take care of the mind. But there's also science to understand and take care of the consciousness, which is that source of awareness that manifests through the body and the mind. The body is always changing from boyhood to youth to old age. And the mind is continuously changing. For instance, at one time, every one of you young men who are now strong, handsome, learned, you were living within the womb of your mother the size of a chickpea. That was you. That was your body. And gradually, as the months went on by, little hands started growing, legs started growing, a head started growing, then there was a formation of eyes and ears and nose, and then soon they could actually register a heartbeat, and soon you're kicking your legs to get out. Then you come out. You're an infant. And what do you understand as an infant? What is your mental condition? You simply want to be protected by your mother, her embrace, and you want the milk from her body. That was your mind and body. Now, how many of you today are thinking of drinking the milk from your mother's body? And how many of you today even resemble that infant child that you were, say, 20 years ago? Your body has completely changed. Virtually not even recognizable. And your mind has completely changed. You weren't thinking of your future marriage or your future exams when you were a baby child. So you have a different body and a different mind. But your mother and your father, they love you as the same person that little child represented. They know you're the same person. All your relatives know you're the same person. But physically and mentally, there's nothing in common. So what is it that is consistent through all the changes of the body and life? It is consciousness. The awareness. Sometimes we are perceiving life through a baby's body and mind. Sometimes we are perceiving life through an elderly person's body and mind. Are we the eyes or are we seeing through our eyes? Are we our ears or are we hearing through our ears? Are we our mouth or are we speaking through our mouth? Who are we? Who is it that is witnessing life through all of these functions of the body? That is the most important question to ask. Because until you understand that, everything you do, everything you learn, has very little meaning. It's based on an illusion. People criticize religion as being a set of sectarian beliefs or just ritual. But in truth, the source of all religions, whether it be the Hindu religion, the Muslim religion, the Buddhist religion, the Christian religion, or the Jewish religion, it is a great deep education in science. But of course, the perversion of that, because people do not approach it in a scientific manner, with good intelligence, it deteriorates to simply blind ritual and faith. And most religion throughout the world is nothing more than that. But it is meant to be a great, great science and study by which we can have direct experience, realization, and awareness of the essence of our own lives, ourselves, our consciousness, or our Atma, our soul. What is the nature of consciousness? You'll notice that every creature on earth is longing and striving for one thing, and we all have this in common. In this room tonight, there are many mosquitoes. Why are the mosquitoes anxious to drink your blood? Because it gives them pleasure, correct? One man's food is another man's poison. The mosquitoes are looking for pleasure, and their pleasure is your blood. Now, in human life, there might be a very beautiful woman, but she's also looking for your blood. Semen is a concentrated form of blood. She's looking for pleasure by drinking your blood. Is there really any difference? They are both pleasure-seeking. The insignificant ant is looking for pleasure in a grain of sugar. And we're looking for pleasure by going to the cafeteria to eat nice food. Why are you going to college? What is your motivation? It's for pleasure. Because by having a nice family, by having a nice income, by having a prestigious position in society, you'll be happy. You'll feel pleasure. And perhaps you could share that pleasure with others. And similarly, the tiger in the forest is raising a family, protecting its family, eating the deers for pleasure. The birds are building their nests, which is a perfect home for them, bringing worms to their children, because it gives them pleasure. Everyone has one thing in common, the search for pleasure. And this whole world is simply being orchestrated by this one principle, the pursuit of pleasure. Some people find pleasure in killing other people. Some people find pleasure in feeding the poor and saving the lives of the dying on the street. Some find pleasure by dropping atom bombs and killing millions of people with one push of the button from their finger. And some people find pleasure by going to these places where the disasters take place and try their best to help everybody, to again be substantiated with a decent life. The motive for the criminal and the motive for the saint, the motive for the insect and the motive for the prime minister is pleasure. Why is it that everyone has this in common? Not only every human being, but every species of life. Instinctively, it's not that we're trained to look for pleasure. Does anyone have to teach you in college how to look for pleasure? You automatically do that. They just teach you how, they don't teach you how to look for it, they teach you how to get it, according to different avenues of occupation and lifestyle. But we are all pleasure seeking. Why is this? Because the soul, the consciousness, the source of all life within all bodies of all creatures on earth is pleasure seeking. Because the soul in and of itself is Satchit Ananda, eternal, full of knowledge and full of pleasure. That infinite pleasure that everyone is seeking is the very nature of our own consciousness. And it is our nature to be experiencing this ananda, or this pleasure, utter fulfillment at all times. But why are we not experiencing it? Why do we have to grope and search and reach out everywhere and anywhere trying to find something if it's right inside of us? Why are we so frustrated, seeking more and more and more, and however much we get, it's never enough? And even if we get enough, somehow or other, we're always afraid of losing it. And inevitably, we will. Therefore, even when you have pleasure, you can't really enjoy it because there's always the fear of losing it. If it is true that there is pure, unlimited pleasure within us, which is the very inherent nature of our soul, of our consciousness, why are we in this dilemma? It's very simple. Because we have forgotten who we are. There was a very famous book written in America. It was a very, very famous book, very wide read. It's considered a classic. And it was about a man who heard about a valuable, rare treasure. And he spent his whole life traveling all over the world searching for this treasure. And he died in the search. And then his child happened to be digging a well in his father's own backyard and found the treasure there. What's in our own backyard, what's in our own heart, because we're not aware of its presence, we're trying to find that everywhere in and everything. And actually, this was the symbolism of this book, that man is roaming through so many experiences in life, pursuing so many occupations in life, trying so many things to find that fulfillment, that pleasure, that peace, but he's forgetting that it's right within your own heart. Of course, you've probably heard this many times before, and theoretically it sounds nice, but it's meaningless unless we experience that pleasure, that truth. And a real science is, first you must be convinced on the basis of theory that it's reasonable, that it's logical that this can be true. Sometimes people say, can you prove to me that there's a soul? Can you prove to me that there's a God? It's like a man who has his eyes closed and says, can you prove to me that there's a sun in the sky? There's only one thing you can do. You can try to logically, philosophically, systematically provide theories that are so convincing to that person that he's willing to open his eyes. And when he opens his eyes, is there any need for any further evidence? The soul is like the brilliant sun giving light within our hearts. But due to the misconception of forgetfulness, it's like a dark, dark, dark cloud. Because we have closed our inner eyes to what is within. For so long, we don't even know how to open them. We don't even believe that there can be something so idealistic as what all the great saints and all the great scriptures have been talking about, and all great philosophers throughout history. Simply, we must learn how to open our eyes. How to again be reminded of who we are. And of course, after being theoretically convinced that this makes sense, that this is certainly a positive alternative to simply an existence of going to school, making a lot of money, having a nice family, growing old, getting diseased, and dying. Is there something more to life than this? Have we been created in this earth for a deeper purpose than just this? If there is, and it is logical, that I am that consciousness within, that spiritual nature that is animating and observing through this body and mind, then it is reasonable to take to the experiment which gives us direct perception. And this is why we call spirituality a science, and it is a science. And the problem with religion is it is not approached scientifically. And because it's not approached scientifically, what do we get out of religion? Sectarianism and fanaticism. It is said that religion without philosophy is simply mental speculation. I'm sorry. Religion without philosophy is either sentimentalism or fanaticism. And how much do we see that right here in India? What to speak of the rest of the world? In Punjab, we have the Sikhs and the Hindus killing each other. In Sri Lanka, we have Buddhists and Hindus killing each other. In various places throughout India, we have Muslims and Hindus killing each other. In the name of one God. In the Granth Sahib, in the Quran, in the New Testament, in the Old Testament, in the Bhagavad Gita, it is explained that there is only one God, the Father of all living beings, the source of everything. None of the scriptures, none of the real saints ever taught anything different. That one God manifests the truth that we are all part of Him. That we are not this body, we are the eternal soul. That the true pleasure we are seeking is in reposing our natural propensity to love in the supreme object of all love. That is the universal principle of religion. That is Sanatana Dharma. So what are we fighting about? We're fighting because we've completely neglected the science, the logic, the philosophy behind religion. And we just become either sectarian, sentimentalist. What is a sentimentalist? One who just does his puja every day. Why? I don't know. Because I'm afraid if I don't, my God might become angry. Or why? Because my mother taught me to do this, and her mother taught her to do this, and her mother taught it's our family tradition to do this puja. Is there any science to that? That's sentimentalism. And fanaticism means my religion is the only way. And every religious scripture teaches that from this religion you will learn how to love indiscriminately and equally every living being, because everyone is part of God. So how is it that through religion there's so much hate and ego? Because it is not understood as it is, in essence, the science. The science of how to perfect your life. The science of how to break through all sectarian, egoistic boundaries and understand truth. And it is also said that religion, philosophy without religion, is simply mental speculation. There are many big, big philosophers who study the scriptures scrutinizingly, but they don't even really believe in what they're doing. It's all a profession. I've had so much experience of this in colleges. Sometimes I'm invited to speak at divinity schools. And sometimes I'm guest speakers of big, big religious professors in their classes. I remember one college. This man, he was a Christian man. This was in Huntington, West Virginia, in the United States. And this professor, he was so well known as being a scholar of the Bible. He was being invited several times a week to various churches by ministers and priests to speak on the Bible, because he was considered such a great man. He just practically had every sentence memorized. And he was the head of the whole religious department. And he had about 30 other professors under him. And they all would learn, and the professors would all learn and study from him because he was an authority. And my God, how people practically worshipped him. So I was giving a series of 7 lectures a day for 7 days. So it was a very full schedule. And 6 in the day and 1 at night. And he arranged all of it. And between the morning sections and the evening sections, he would always call me in his office. And he was always vehemently trying to convert me, according to his logic and philosophy, to follow his religious path. Very, very scrutinizingly, this verse says this, so why don't you do like this? And of course, I would speak logic, that what is this converting from one to another? Why don't you just inspire me to love God instead of converting to your team? And in this way, it went back and forth until the last day. He saw that I was a hopeless case. He wasn't going to get me to accept his external forms. So then he looked at me. He realized that his presentation, his appearance really didn't mean anything. So he decided just to be completely honest with me. And he said, please, Swamiji, I want to know the honest truth from you. And I said, as honest as I can, I'll try to answer your question. What would you like me to say? He said, I don't want you to lie. I don't want you to say anything on the basis that you're a Swami. I just want to know from your heart the answer to my question. I said, what is it? He said, do you really believe that there could be a God? And I said, before I answer this question, I want to know, do you really believe that there could be a God? He said, I asked you first. I said, not only do I believe that there is a God, but by his grace, I am experiencing at every moment his glory and his mercy. He said, that's all nonsense. There is no God. And I looked at him. I said, is that the conclusion of all your studies? Is that the conclusion of all of your sermons and lectures? You don't even believe what you're saying? He said, it's my profession. He says, I've read all the philosophy, I've memorized all the books. It's my profession to do this. But to tell you the truth, I've never even believed it. Of course, he said this while he was smoking cigarettes, and he had two students, young females, outside the door waiting to meet with him after I was to leave. I was wondering why those same two students were coming every night just when I was about to leave. So you see, because he didn't put any of his theoretical understanding to practice in life, there was no realization. There was no experience. Philosophy without devotion, religion, is simply speculation. There's no change of heart. So there has to be a synthesis between the two to come to the conclusion of truth. And this truth, which is hidden within our own hearts, we must make a study and apply certain principles to our life in order to understand that. I have not come here today in any way, shape, or form to convert anyone to one religion or another. After all, this is all a very materialistic conception. What I have come here tonight to do is, according to my small capacity, to try to inspire all of you to take very, very seriously an understanding of this basic question of what is truth, what is the meaning to life, who am I, who is God, and what is my relationship, and to understand the necessity of this education along with whatever other education you are pursuing. Yoga means to link up. Whatever you do, link it up to God. Build your education on the foundation of truth, not illusion. Coming from the country of America, I know very well what is illusion. I see people by the thousands practically daily coming from India to settle down in America, to have a big, nice house, to have a nice car, to have a nice stereo, to have a nice television, to have a telephone in every room, to have toilets that flush every time they press the button, where they can go out into a suburb where everything around them is clean and neat, there's no beggars, where they can drive what we have driven from Tropati to IIT in miles. It took us 2 hours on these crazy roads. In America, on the highways, it would take 10 minutes to drive from Tropati to IIT. Huh? People go to America because they want that. They're chasing after this worldly progress. But when I speak to the Indians, they're having a lot of problems. They have everything, but they're miserable. Because their daughter they found out she was addicted to heroin. Or another one told me their daughter is pregnant. She's only 16, not married. Do you think that such a civilization will bring happiness? I use this example a lot. This is a statistic that 80% of the men, the males, in the upper class bracket of society in America cannot sleep without a sleeping pill. What does that mean? They have a big, beautiful mansion. They have a wonderful family. They have security guards and security alarm devices all around their homes. They have a car for every member of their family. They have stereo television in every bedroom, in every room. They have a beautiful bedstead of silk, sheets, waterbed, mattress. They have everything. And when it's time for them to go to sleep at night, they're so frustrated. They're in so much anxiety that they just roll around in agony. And they have to take a drug to knock them out and put them to sleep. What is the use of such a life? What is the use of everything they have? Here in Bombay, the beggars who are homeless, so many are living right on the sidewalks. They don't have house, they don't have bed, they don't have any security. Sometimes they just have a little potato sack or some little newspaper they put on the sidewalk and they lay on it. Within seconds, they're sound asleep, no sleeping pills. So my question is, who's happier? Who's more at peace with themselves? The beggar. Wealth will never make you happy, no matter how much you make. Prestige and position in society will never make you happy, no matter how much you get. If you can't find happiness within your own heart, you'll not find happiness anywhere by any means. But if you can find that happiness within your own heart, if you can find that purpose and meaning to life, which is a sort of source of happiness, without meaning, can we be happy? Without a real meaning and substance to life, everything is superficial, it's empty. When you have that, whatever you have or you don't have will be a source of joy. And of course, those who are of the intelligent class, those who are in college today, those who are the future leaders of tomorrow in every field of society, the whole world is what you're going to make it. If you find that peace in your own heart, if you find that love in your own heart, everything you do will be motivated by that, and you'll do good for this world and find true fulfillment in your own life. But if you're just simply motivated by greed, what good are you going to do for the world? Science is wonderful, if the scientist is a loving, compassionate man. If the scientist is a frustrated, greedy man, an envious man, then he's going to use his science to destroy the world, not to help the world. Today, the technologies are so much misused. They're destroying the entire environment, and they can't stop. They can't stop producing these things. Why? Because they're so greedy. They want more, 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 more. Let the oceans be polluted. Let the lakes be poisonous. Let the sky be unbreathable in air. Let the ozone completely be destroyed. Let the sun's rays come and cause cancer upon everybody. I don't care, because I want money. It's for me. It's for my family. Science and technology is what's doing that. Who's building the big, big nuclear bombs? The people who were in college yesterday. Those who have big, big PhDs, they're doing it. And who are the politicians that are fighting like dogs and cats simply over a piece of land, trying to protect their position, willing to do anything to stay in office? People in the colleges yesterday. Where's the food shortage coming from? The big business people. There's no shortage of food. The big business people, they decide where food should grow and where it shouldn't grow. Half the land in America is used for growing tobacco instead of food. And grains for alcohol instead of food. The number one cause of death in America is drunken driving. Alcohol kills. Food gives life. They're using as much land to kill as to give life. Why? It's not that they're so compassionate they just want everybody to have a drink. They know there's money in it, and they want money, and they don't give a darn who dies. They might not say that, but by their actions, it speaks louder than their words. I'm speaking my own experience in America. I know these things. I'm there. I do welfare projects. They spend millions and millions and millions of dollars a year to store food in warehouses. And if you try to ask them, I want to give it to starving people in the ghetto who are eating rats, can you give me some of it? You have to go through oceans.